Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, and Rob Moore is here with the news, and I'm your host Lauren Corman in here with Lamia Teking, and we got cut off in the middle of our conversation because I was congratulating Rob Moore for his wonderful article that he just published, that was just published in Lifelines magazine, which is put out by the Toronto Vegetarian Association, and it's about pumping iron vegan style. And it's a great article, and so I'm hoping that maybe in the next couple of weeks you'll read it for us on the air for people who don't get a subscription to that. But
it's just fun because so many people say that, you know, that you can't be big and muscular on a vegan diet. Not that I am big and muscular myself, but I just I always like to refute the norm.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to put that out there and show people that there are sites like veganfitness.com and, or is it veganfitness.net? veganfitness.net and veganbodybuilding.org that have a wealth of vegans who are into bodybuilding and body sculpting. And it's an interesting burgeoning community that is definitely challenging a lot of notions.
Mm-hmm. And you're not skinny either.
Well, I'm not skinny, but I mean, I'm fit.
Win a free date with Rob Moore and Animal Voices.
You're embarrassing me, Lauren. But definitely I like to have these conversations with people about fitness, and they claim that you can't get all the nutrients on a vegan diet when, of course, that's ludicrous.
Mm-hmm. So. And there's people that are getting really big. I mean, on the cover of the Lifelines newsletter/magazine, there's a huge bodybuilder who is vegan on it, and it's just pretty astounding. I mean, we had Robbie Hazley on a while ago, who was the wonderful British chap who talked with us about vegan bodybuilding, and I just really liked how you wrote the article, because you start from that position of speaking with someone, i.e. your dad, who quite skeptical about whether or not you could get big. And I love your mention of the gorillas and how the gorillas are vegetarian. They're huge.
Dad, the gorillas are herbivores. How did they get so big?
Yeah.
So
anyway, so I would definitely encourage our listeners to go check it out. And hopefully Rob will grace us maybe with reading at least an excerpt of it in on one of the upcoming shows. So today's program, we're going to be speaking with Deborah Wasserman, who is the co-coordinator and co-founder of the Baltimore-based Vegetarian Resource Group, also known as VRG. And she's a prolific cookbook author as well. And her books are put out through the Vegetarian Resource Group. And according to their website, the Vegetarian Resource Group is a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating the public on vegetarianism and the interrelated issues of health, nutrition, ecology, ethics, and world hunger. In addition to publishing the Vegetarian Journal, which is really amazing, the VRG produces and sells cookbooks, books, pamphlets, and article reprints. And Deborah's cookbooks include Vegetarianism for the Working Person, Meatless Meals for Working People, Simply Vegan, which is co-authored by her, and the Low-Fat Jewish Vegetarian Cookbook. And she's also the past editor of the really amazing Vegetarian Journal. So she's going to tell us all about running the Vegetarian Resource Group, as well as all the different questions that she's fielded over the years. Some of the ones that stand out for her, people's concerns about vegetarianism and how she responds to them. And we'll also hear about her cookbooks, which really are geared towards making vegetarianism and veganism accessible and fun and nutritious for people. So I'm looking forward to having her on the program. But before we jump into our interview with Deborah, we're going to hear some news with Rob Moore.
Some news. Okay, well, first I tried to make it a lot of good news today, but we'll see where we go. This is from channelnewsasia.com. Beijing is considering draft laws to protect animal welfare in what would be the first legislation of its kind in the country. The regulations would ban abuse against animals and contain requirements on how they should be treated, including how they are transported or slaughtered. The proposal comes after China carried out mass slaughters of civet cats last year to fight SARS, which is suspected to be transmitted from wildlife to humans. China also killed millions of chickens, ducks, and other fowl in several provinces to fight bird flu this year. Images of civet cats dumped in large vats of disinfectant to be drowned and of poultry being stuffed into sacks and burned alive were splashed on TV screens and newspapers during the culls. The new regulation stipulates, among other things, that no one should harass, mistreat, or hurt animals, that while carrying animals from one place to another, the vehicles used must be kept clean and animals must be protected from suffering shock, torture, or harm. If animals have to be slaughtered out of necessity, such as to control the spread of animal epidemics, they must be killed in a humane way that will cause them the least pain. and they also must be first put under anesthesia and not be killed in front of other animals. So hopefully these regulations will soon be enforced. We'll be watching for that. And the Peaceful Parks Coalition released this statement today. The Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources has taken a short reprieve from shooting double-crested cormorants at High Bluff Island in Presque Isle Provincial Park because the birds are getting skittish. The ministry shot and killed 320 birds on the first day, May 6th, 150 on the second day, and 50 on the third. The ministry will begin oiling ground nests on Tuesday. That's today. The group traveled to the island on Sunday and Monday and found many empty nests and dispersed adult cormorants. The ministry kills one adult from each nesting pair. Since it takes two adults to incubate a clutch, the remaining adult is forced to abandon the nest and the eggs will be left to rot. The ministry is also using low-velocity lead bullets. They intend to shoot 6,000 birds and leave them to decompose on the island. The government is killing these birds because they claim their guano destroys the vegetation, but what sort of impact will all the lead bullets and 6,000 rotting birds have on the soil and vegetation, asks Anna Maria Velastro of the Peaceful Parks Coalition. The Liberal government has imposed a blackout on their activities, including a 200-meter buffer around the island, and has shut down a large portion of the campground on the mainland. There was also no press releases announcing the decision on either the ministry's website or Ontario Parks. David Ramsey believes once the killing begins, people will just surrender to the idea, says Velastro, but they're mute on their decision because they're ashamed. Cormorants don't destroy vegetation any more than forest fires destroy forests. Large birds need trees denuded of foliage because they are too large to fly into the branches otherwise. They're just creating a habitat for themselves. So letters need to be written to all levels of the Liberal government. You can go to www.peacefulparks.org, and they've got the address and a letter for David Ramsey, though it's recommended you write your own letter. And this is another Environment Canada news release. On May 6th, David Anderson, Minister of the Environment, tabled legislation in the House of Commons that will allow Canada to more forcefully protect its marine environment from polluters. Marine waters off Canada's coasts are among the world's richest in terms of seabird life, and we are determined to better protect them, said Anderson. The legislation we are tabling today will raise fines to $1 million. It will also make the ship's officers accountable for their actions and help harmonize our approach with that of the United States. An act to amend the Migratory Birds Convention Act and the Canadian Environmental Protection Act will more effectively address enforcement issues in case of marine pollution. Environment Canada's research shows that more than 300,000 seabirds are being killed each year off the coast of Atlantic Canada by the illegal discharge of oily bilge waste from passing ships. And an exciting article from the New York Times, the egg industry should stop advertising its products as humane as long as it continues such practices as clipping hens' beaks and depriving birds of food and water, according to a ruling issued Monday by the Better Business Bureau. The ruling comes from the Bureau's New York-based National Advertising Review Board, its highest authority on advertising issues. The board recommended that the United Egg Producers either discontinue labeling eggs as animal care certified or significantly alter it to stop misleading consumers. It is unimaginable that consumers would consider treatment they find unacceptable to be humane treatment, the ruling stated. Compliance with the recommendations are voluntary, but groups that refuse to do so are often referred to federal agencies, like the Federal Trade Commission or the FDA. The board found that the egg industry's standards have improved treatment of hens, but not to a level that most consumers would find humane. Among the practices cited were forced molting, which is intentionally withholding food and water to make birds lose weight, partial beak clipping without anesthesia to prevent birds from pecking each other, and dense crowding of hens in cages that don't allow them to flap their wings. The ruling stems from a complaint by Compassion Over Killing, a Washington, D.C.-based animal rights group. So please join me in congratulating them. And Lami is applauding, but you can't hear her. We'll have to get some sound effects here. And this is a fun article from the Globe and Mail. They had an article this past week called Nintendo for Soy Lovers. It's not your usual video game. Instead of fragging aliens or carjacking Ferraris, a soon-to-be-released game encourages players to break into hamburger joints and animal testing laboratories, all in the hope of building a cruelty-free, public transit-taking, tofu-munching utopia. and if video game distributors buy into Steer Madness next week when the game's Canadian developer pitches it at the Electronic Entertainment Expo in L.A., cattle ranchers could soon have more than mad cow disease to fear. It's quite possible that it will sway a few people, Jonathan Skinner, the game's 27-year-old developer, says from Vancouver. Skinner readily confesses that he has a political agenda. He is a committed vegan and a regular volunteer for animal rights groups such as PETA. But he has never had the nerve for hardcore civil disobedience, so I created the game to do it for me, he said. He hopes to release it in time for next Christmas. And just for an example, on one mission, a steer must covertly switch a restaurant's supply order for beef burgers to 100% vegetable and soy protein patties. On another, he has to infiltrate a lab to free its animals. In a screenshot shown on the game's internet site, a busty woman in a shirt that reads vegan is shown to a baby harp seal as they mourn a dead rabbit. "Those bastards, the cosmetics lab," the woman tells the seal. "They killed him." You like that? I was working on it. "Those bastards." Strident, perhaps, but Mr. Skinner's creation could fill a gaping niche in the video game market. For many vegetarians, video games and their frequent violence are only a little less taboo than, say, a milk-fed veal chop grilled bloody rare. True vegans don't suffer the violent, angry impulses that meat eaters do, so they definitely don't play video games, an interesting theory by Jerry Coffey, North America representative for the International Vegetarian Union. Steer Madness will change that, promises Mr. Skinner, who built his programming career on more mainstream gaming hits such as Homeworld 2. "Our video game is completely non-violent. Nobody gets hurt," he says. "Even the steer, when he falls off his bike, he just gets back up again." And that sounds pretty decent to me.
Thank you, Rob.
You're welcome.
I definitely think we should get the creator of that on the program.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Okay, so
I want to play it.
I will make a commitment to our listeners that I will try my very best to get him on the program in the next couple of weeks, because that sounds like it would be really interesting to talk to him. So we're going to come back and have an interview with Deborah Wasserman, who's the co-founder and co-coordinator of the Vegetarian Resource Group that is based out of Baltimore. We are speaking with Deborah Wasserman. I hope I'm saying your name correctly.
Yes, you are. Hi.
Okay, super. And Deborah is the co-founder and co-coordinator of the Vegetarian Resource Group, which is based out of Baltimore, as well as a very prolific cookbook author. And I'm really excited to have you here today. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
So maybe just for people who are unfamiliar with the Vegetarian Resource Group, I know a lot of my friends do make use of the group, although we're in Toronto, but can you tell us a bit about the VRG?
Okay, we're a educational nonprofit headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland in the U.S. We're a large national group here, but we do have, as you said, many members in Canada, as well as Asia, South America, Europe, and so on. We started in the fall of 1982 as a local vegetarian group, and at the time it was called Baltimore Vegetarians. Myself and Charles Stoller, who co-founded the group with me, were both active in the Vegetarian Society in Washington, D.C., and the North American Vegetarian Society when we moved to Baltimore. And we decided if there wasn't a local group here, we'd start one, and we found out there wasn't. And we knew some people from Baltimore that were vegetarian because they used to drive an hour to Washington, D.C. to go to veggie events because they were that interested. And a group of us started a group, and we quickly grew because we had experience organizing nonprofits, and we had experience organizing events and putting a newsletter together, which many people know is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we right away started having monthly activities locally, and by the mid-1980s, we began publishing all types of materials, both handouts and books and brochures. And what we did is whenever we produced something new, we sent out a press release to the national media, because we realized that there was a lot of interest outside of just our local area, and if we're going to do all the work to produce something, we might as well share it with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we started gaining a lot of members outside of Maryland. And in fact, by the end of the 1980s, we realized we had many more members outside of Maryland. So we officially changed the name of the organization to the Vegetarian Resource Group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really incredible. I mean, it's an organization that's been around for a long time now. And yeah, it's I feel like it's one of the veteran groups out there that's been doing stuff. So can you tell us a bit more about how many people are involved in running this organization that helps so many people in different parts of the world?
Right. Well, we have 5 staff members in the Baltimore office, and we also have a paid staff member that works as a consultant in Los Angeles, California, and she deals with a lot of activities for us on the West Coast. But in addition, we also have about a dozen or so freelance writers and artists that contribute regularly to Vegetarian Journal, which is our quarterly magazine, and some of them also contribute to our books and brochures. And finally, we have many, many, many volunteers throughout the U.S. And these include registered dietitians, doctors, computer specialists, editors, proofreaders, you name it. We put them to work, and we're very lucky in that many of these individuals have been volunteering for VRG over 10 years now and are extremely dedicated and give us a lot of time. Couldn't do it otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
We also have people that table for us throughout the U.S. on a regular basis on any weekend. We could be in several states, and we're busy in the office packing materials and shipping them out. We also have people that do presentations for the group in other states and do media interviews around the country.
And what would you say is the sort of the primary goal or goals of the organization? I mean, with a name like the Vegetarian Resource Group, it's very friendly sounding. It's it doesn't seem too confrontational. Who's the audience that you're really looking to do outreach with, and who are you there to serve in terms of a community?
Right. Well, the audience is broad in the sense, I mean, obviously people who are already vegan or vegetarian will come to us to get, have specific questions answered, or just looking for new ideas, what to cook for dinner or something like
mm-hmm.
that. But basically our goal is to reach out to mainstream and to get more and more individuals interested in becoming vegan. Our goal is to make it easy so that you could be vegetarian at school and colleges, at your workplace, anywhere in your community when you go out to eat. All of our nutrition-related materials are written by registered dietitians or doctors, and that was a big change early on in the vegetarian movement in that since our goal was to reach mainstream, we wanted, for example, if some teenager in Toronto decides to become vegetarian and their parents insist that they see a dietitian, that when they go to the dietitian's office, the dietitian mm-hmm. doesn't tell them it's too dangerous, don't do it. What we want is to have dietitians that who may not even be vegetarian but have good information showing that it's healthy and okay to become vegan or vegetarian. So we've worked really hard on doing that. Basically, we answer a lot of questions. Our website, which is vrg.org, is number one on Google and Yahoo when you search on vegetarian, and we get a huge number of people every month coming to our site. And the questions are everything from the basic, like what do I eat,
mm-hmm.
to, what is this ingredient on a food label, or where can I find non-leather shoes because I don't want to wear leather anymore. And so we're always answering lots and lots of questions, both for the consumer and media and professionals.
Wow.
Like I said, we're always just trying to make it easy everywhere. For example, this past year we exhibited at the National Restaurant Association Convention, which in the U.S. was in Chicago, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And that's attended by over 75,000 people in the restaurant industry. And our goal there is to encourage mainstream restaurants to add more vegan options to their menu. And in order to do that, we also provide the chefs with materials to do this, and we gave away several hundred free subscriptions to our Food Service Update, which is a newsletter for food service,
mm-hmm.
which has quantity recipes. So we're not only saying do it, but we're giving them the materials to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So this way, when you eat out, even if it's a steakhouse,
right,
they'll start adding on options if you give them materials and how to do it.
I just wanted to share with you a couple of anecdotes. A friend of mine, this was a few years ago, and we had both gone vegan about the same time, and she was going out after she'd finished her undergraduate degree, and a bunch of her friends in the program were going to go out to a restaurant, a very mainstream sort of steak and potatoes kind of place, and she went beforehand because she's very diligent and considers herself a strong Capricorn, and went beforehand and found out what was on the menu, and there wasn't anything literally she could eat as a vegan, and so she ended up bringing her own ingredients. Mm-hmm. And she just brought them and sort of plunked them down on the table and said, you know, I really encourage the chef to use these and make me something that I can eat. And so, I mean, I thought that was really valiant of her, but I mean, most people really wouldn't go to that
right.
extent. So it seems like it's a pretty important thing to be able to make sure that there are options at least.
Right, and you want to know what was real interesting. This was late last fall that we did the latest booth at the National Restaurant Show. An interesting thing that came up on from several people attending was the veto factor, and what they meant is today there are so many people that are either totally vegetarian or pretty much vegetarian mm-hmm. that if a restaurant doesn't offer vegetarian options, they would lose customers. And the way that happens is, let's say six people are going out to eat. If even one person wants vegetarian food, if that restaurant doesn't have vegetarian food on its menu, they may go somewhere else mm-hmm. to eat, all the six people. So all the restaurants are realizing this veto thing that the vegetarian can make everyone leave and go somewhere else that
right.
they don't provide for the vegetarian.
Right. So I'm really curious about, I mean, you've been involved with these issues for a long time now. I don't want to make you sound terribly old or anything, but you're
about able. About 25 years.
You've had your finger on the pulse of the vegetarian movement now for, you know, a quarter of a century. and it's pretty incredible. I'm sure you've seen some changes and also some setbacks. And I was wondering if you could reflect a little bit about how you see vegetarianism progressing or not. For example, people often ask me questions about if it is getting easier for vegetarians and vegans, especially in light of the Atkins diet and, you know, vegetarianism also getting spun as being sort of another fad diet and, you know, is vegetarianism going by the wayside as these diets such as the Atkins diet or in the Zone diet take their place? But at the same time, you know, there's concerns about mad cow and other disease, affecting so-called farm animals. So I was just curious about where have you seen the movement go, and what do you think is in the future for vegetarianism?
Well, one thing that's good is you've been doing this long enough, you've seen many fad diets come and go.
Yeah.
I mean, there was the very low fat, there was the low salt, there's the Atkins diet, there's the low carb. I mean, there's always a wave of diets, and some last longer than others. But vegetarianism has been around forever and ever, and I think most professionals don't consider it a fad, which means that we're well established now, which is a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Not seen as a fad diet anymore. And the number of people who are vegetarian just continues to climb steadily. We actually commission national polls every 3 years to keep track of the growth of vegetarians in the country and vegans.
Mm-hmm.
And in the U.S., for many, many years, it was about 1% of the population. And then a couple years ago, it jumped up to about 3%. And actually, 1% of the country is now vegan in the U.S.
Wow.
Which is a huge number of people. And, I mean, I didn't imagine that would happen, but I mean, and I think that the numbers will go up. Yes, it's tough, you know. I mean, I've been in airports listening to the people next to me talk about the Atkins diet and what they're eating, and all I keep thinking is, I'm like on the anti-Atkins diet.
Right.
I just eat completely the opposite of what they're all eating.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, I mean, this is a sidetrack, but recently in the U.S., there's a magazine called Parade Magazine that's in all the national newspapers on Sunday.
Okay.
And on the back page, they ran Atkins group, whatever it is, ran a copy of the Atkins pyramid.
Right.
And I think that they're trying to clear up the misconception that you can eat all the cheeseburgers you want and be healthy, because
mm-hmm.
that's never what the science has shown in the Atkins diet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never what they were really saying. But people took it that way because that's what they want to hear.
Sure.
And so if you looked at their pyramid, it's actually easy to be vegetarian and vegan and do the Atkins diet. They have tofu on the bottom of the pyramid, just as big as meat.
Hmm.
And I'm not saying go on the Atkins diet, but you can you could take any diet and do it veggie style if you wanted to do that.
Yeah.
But we push that you eat a wide variety.
Yeah. And that's interesting what you said about veganism. I know when I went vegan about, I don't know, 6 years ago or something now, it really was a weird word still for people, and lots of really difficult social situations that I was faced. And not like it was horrible, but there was definitely like a continual sense of educating people about just even what the word means, which is a diet free of animal products altogether, as much as possible. I mean, within the degree that you can be vegan, I aim towards. So it's interesting to see that that at least is growing in terms of, you know, people's understanding or consciousness.
Exactly.
around the term. Do you find that heartening? I mean, I'm always...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I first wrote Simply Vegan, there were very, very few vegan cookbooks out. And I know, I mean, one of the main reasons for doing it is no one knew what it was. And for that matter, probably thought it was totally crazy and difficult. And so, sure, I mean, still today, when I read an editorial in a newspaper that instead of referring to even the word vegetarian, I actually use the word vegan, I can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's fantastic, because then the more people see the word will say, well, what is that?
Right.
And look for information.
And the fact that more people can pronounce vegan nowadays.
Right, we're not vagrants.
That's progress, right?
We're not vegan.
That's funny. So one of the things that some of my friends are continually disheartened about is that when people become vegetarian or vegan, sometimes they go back and to eating meat or resuming their original diet. And I was wondering if the Vegetarian Resource Group also does outreach or fields a lot of questions for people who were once vegetarian or vegan but just couldn't maintain it anymore, and what some of your suggestions are for people who would be
right.
in that category.
We've gotten a fair number of people in that category that actually, for whatever reason, come back and they're interested in it again. I'll give you a broad example that we've seen in the U.S. and probably Canada too, but in the 60s when we had all these hippies that were going vegetarian because it was the cool thing to do,
right.
A lot of people at that time who were vegetarian by the 70s and 80s stopped being vegetarian.
Hmm.
And what's happening is a lot of their children are becoming vegetarian, and instead of having parents that are against your doing it, the parents are actually quite supportive because they had done it. And so what we'll see is people who tell us, well, I was vegetarian in the 60s, now my son or daughter wants to be, so now we're going to go back to it, and it's a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. It's like me and my mom. Exactly the same situation.
I mean, and that's actually quite common, so it might explain why a lot of the kids today are getting less opposition, not to say that none do, but a lot more getting support, at least from their mothers.
Yeah.
And the kids are bringing back the parents, and at that time, and a lot of those parents at this point are having health problems.
Right.
And so they're actually glad to go back to a vegetarian diet and also know that the whole family would be eating the same way.
Hmm. So in terms of your own vision or the vision of the Vegetarian Resource Group, I don't know if it's one unitary thing at this point, but what do you hope to see in terms of vegetarianism? People are asking me, do you want a vegan world? Is that what you're aiming towards? What's your agenda?
I want a nonviolent world,
right.
Which seems very difficult these days.
Yeah.
My being vegan is part of a bigger, broad outlook on life. However, obviously, I would love for everybody to be vegan, and I think the key to doing that is to make it easy, accessible, like you said earlier on, and I mean, it's happening, and then you just have to deal with the psychological of getting people to make changes in eating habits. But if restaurants everywhere are offering wonderful vegan food, it'll sell.
Mm-hmm.
It'll sell. It's availability and taste. You know, if it's good, it'll go.
Do you have people ever calling the Vegetarian Resource Group who are quite anti-vegetarian, who, you know, accuse you all of being a bunch of nutcases and that type of thing?
They rarely call. They email because that's impersonal.
Okay.
But actually, we don't get very much of it. I mean, we actually have members from, like, the cattle industry and the dairy industry, and I know that they're screening us all the time. But we actually very, very rarely get... that kind of stuff.
Right. Such a friendly organization. So tell us a bit about your cookbooks. I was astounded. Maybe other people who are in the cookbook industry, if we can call it that, write as many cookbooks as you have. But I was really impressed when I was looking at the range of different books that you've put out. And the one that I was most familiar was Simply Vegan. And I was just curious if you could talk to us about your cookbooks and maybe the progression in your cookbooks and what types of cookbooks you've put together over the years.
Sure. One thing that's interesting with the history of it, back in the early 1980s when we started thinking about publishing books, first we had done some handouts, and then all of a sudden we have all these materials, why not put it into book form? And so we actually originally approached several mainstream publishers, and in the early 80s, when I say that, it's probably about 84 or something, 83, when we approached mainstream publishers, no one felt there was a market for quick and easy vegetarian cookbooks. And as we all know, that's been proven to be wrong.
Right. People want difficult, inconvenient cookbooks.
Right, exactly. I mean, we were so right and so on target. The market is huge for quick and easy cookbooks and vegetarian cookbooks. So since none of the mainstream publishers were interested, the Vegetarian Resource Group decided to publish books on by ourselves mm-hmm. without using a publisher. And at the time, not a lot of people were doing it. Now with all the PCs, everybody's doing it. Mm-hmm. But we know we were right because we've sold over 250,000 books. And today, mainstream publishers are begging to publish some of our books, but we don't need them.
Right.
But I would say before we started doing quick and easy cookbooks, most of the vegetarian cookbooks made vegetarianism seem so complicated and time-consuming. It was kind of like, back to nature, gourmet. I don't want to even say gourmet. They were, and I'm not saying it's bad. I mean, you know, cooking beans from scratch is good. I'm not arguing it's not, but the fact is that today people for various reasons are extremely busy or just don't want to spend time cooking, and so they will open up a can of beans. In the past, I think a lot of the cookbooks turned off many people that perhaps would have become vegetarian and just gave up because it's too time consuming.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think there are still so many concerns about whether or not you can be healthy, and you know, people saying things like, I know there's a literature out there, and it seems to have infused the population, you know, in terms of food combining, you know, but don't you have to be very careful? You know, you have to make sure you're getting the proper amounts of proteins, and doesn't this take a lot of time to figure out which grains you're eating, and isn't it all about lentils and those types of concerns that people have? I think that's still very present. In Canada, it seems, anyway.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit less so here now, but that's one issue the Vegetarian Resource Group has worked a great deal on. We exhibit for the past almost 15 years now at the American Dietetic Association Conference, and those are the individuals that are coming out with all the nutrition research and publishing it in professional journals, and for a long, long time, vegetarianism, any articles that were written on it, either A, like you said, made it difficult, or B, just stressed all the problems that they perceived. But a lot of it was not based on real science, and so we got a whole lot of nutrition individuals with degrees working on this issue, and now they're writing the position papers for the ADA and writing materials under the ADA name that are accurate and promote vegetarianism in a positive way.
Mm.
And I think it's also happening in Canada now. I know many, many dietitians up there now, in the past couple of years, have been doing the same thing. And I think it takes a while for it to trickle down. And we've been doing it 15 years, and I think it's finally gotten to the point where, unless it's an older dietitian, all the younger ones know that, you know, that whole combining protein thing was completely bogus,
mm-hmm.
and that you need to just eat a wide variety during the day.
Mm.
And I think that in Canada, it's happening now. And in fact, the most recent position paper on vegetarianism written by dietitians with both a U.S. and Canadian paper was done. And so it'll just take a few more years to get it out of their mind. And it makes a huge difference when it's not presented as being this difficult thing. And I always find it funny when health professionals are always saying, oh, you got to worry about this, you got to worry about that. But if you look at mainstream individuals' diets, you should be saying, worry about this, worry about that.
Yeah.
You know, you got all this obesity going on. Why aren't they putting up, you know, red flags about mainstream diets? more often.
It seems that it seems like in terms of people's dietary choices that any kind of anything you're putting in your mouth, it's always good to know about it. And one of the things that we're always trying to do on Animal Voices is strike a balance between saying, you know, veganism and vegetarianism is very easy and it can be very convenient and nutritious. But like with any diet, of course, you'd want to do your homework. And we've had the authors of Becoming Vegetarian and Becoming
Great.
Vegan on the
mm-hmm.
program. And I feel like that they do such a good job of sort of saying, you know, like, yeah, we if you have questions about B12, we have people who call in and ask us about B12, even though we're not talking about veganism, which I think is still awesome, but there are these concerns out there, and you know, yeah, it's good to know what you're eating, but of course, yeah, this would apply to a mainstream diet as well. You want to know what you're putting in your body.
But you know, a lot of especially young kids and even preteens that become vegetarian, I a lot who are doing it for animal rights reasons or environmental reasons, I tell them that you need to eat well and not get sick. If you get sick, you're a bad role model for veganism or vegetarianism. And so I think when you tell them that and say, you know, you need to eat more than just French fries and salad,
right.
That if you present it to them that way, that you're being a role model for the diet, that they'll actually think about what they're eating and try to do better. You know, young people especially are not concerned about health
okay.
until it's too late.
I find that as somebody who's doing a degree right now up at York University, and that I'm focusing on factory farming and slaughterhouse issues, that whenever I'm really tired and I come to school and there's huge bags under my eyes and I just look messed up, I always think, no, I'm like the ambassador of veganism right now, and I just look like hell. And so there's that extra pressure to try to look perky.
Get some sleep.
Because this might be the first time somebody, you know, you talk with somebody about your research,
yeah.
and they're going to ask, of course, what do you eat, you know, so... I definitely feel that pressure.
No wonder you look like crap.
It's like, no, it's because I've been writing a paper and I haven't slept in 5 days. So your books, you just put out a recent book called The Low-Fat Vegetarian or Jewish Vegetarian Cookbook?
Yeah, that was a little while ago.
Okay.
The Vegetarian Resource Group has now published three Jewish-oriented cookbooks. The first one I did was a no-cholesterol Passover cookbook, which was vegan, and I did that personally because once I became vegan and tried to maintain a vegan diet during Passover, it was like a nightmare, because if anyone knows, there's a lot of dietary restrictions during Passover, including you're not supposed to eat beans, which includes soy products,
right.
and then you're not supposed to eat rice, you're not supposed to eat this unless you're Sephardic, and it was a huge, huge challenge. It was a lot of fun, and I'll tell you, creating recipes for that book was like a lot of mistakes and throwing out.
Oh, yeah?
But once it was done, it was great. And then later on, I did the low-fat Jewish vegetarian cookbook because I felt most of the Jewish cookbooks that were out on the market at the time were not only not vegetarian or vegan-friendly, they were also not low-fat.
Hmm.
And there was a move towards low-fat diets, and there's a lot of heart disease and obesity problems in the Jewish population, so I knew there was a need for it.
Hmm.
And then our first Passover book did so well, and we recently had Nancy Berkoff, who writes for us, do a second, actually, vegan Passover recipe cookbook. And there's a huge amount of interest for it for various reasons.
Hmm. I have absolutely no idea how one sits down and writes a cookbook. Can you give us some insight into
sure.
what that process is like, or how you develop a new recipe, or
yeah.
how you got started?
Well, for me, it was more seeing the need. Like I said, because all the cookbooks were just, generally speaking, going back in time, very complicated, and I never had the time to do what most of the cookbooks had at that time. And like I said, our goal is always to make it easier for people to be vegetarian. And for myself, basically, I look at cooking as a science.
Hmm.
I like exploring, and I'll often create recipes that combine foods that most people wouldn't dare combine.
Okay, such as?
One of the books I wrote a few years ago was Conveniently Vegan, which basically, the way the book works is you take a convenience food in either supermarket or natural food store and then add stuff to it, but they're all quick and easy.
Okay.
And like some of the strange combinations, I'll give you like one side dish combines okra, tomatoes, water chestnuts with Indian seasoning.
Hmm.
So you've got okra tomatoes and then a Chinese food with Indian seasoning.
Hmm.
I have another one where it's just a pasta dish with a tomato and peach sauce using Indian spices.
Uh-huh.
And then one that several people have actually written to me that they've made and love, but they were so afraid to even try it, was a veggie burger made with kidney beans and peaches combined.
You love the peaches.
Hmm.
And, well, no, in this particular, it just happens to be. That's the only two. But it's like the sweet with kidney beans making a burger.
Okay.
And people like kidney beans and peaches in a burger.
Right.
It is really good.
Right.
Really, really good. So I just, I don't know, I have fun. I have fun.
So what is the actual process like? Do you have an idea then? So you're going to start
What I do is before I start actually writing a cookbook, I'll spend several months just thinking about ideas and just writing down notes everywhere. Like every time I'm in even like Conveniently Vegan, I just would go into a supermarket or a natural food store and stare at the shelves.
Hmm.
I'm serious. And then just think, okay, what would nobody combine in this store?
Huh.
Or what would, you know, I try to come up with new ideas that no one's done. I mean, it's hard.
Right.
Very, very hard. I think, you know, I talk to a lot of people now who are writing vegetarian cookbooks. They'll contact me or the group, and, you know, and I think they all find out how difficult it is to come up with, let's say, 100 to 200 recipes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're really creating and not just taking off from other people,
right.
It's hard. It takes a long, long time to do.
One of the things that I remember reading in a book by Carol Adams, where she talks about if you're going to a social event and you're the only vegetarian or vegan there, you know, make sure you bring something really tasty and bring a lot of food for everybody to try, and that, you know, this is a great way of introducing vegetarian or vegan food to different audiences. And I'm imagining bringing something that has peaches in a burger into it, and people might love it, but they'll be already going to be skeptical of vegan and vegetarian food. Do you have sort of the comfort foods as well represented in your books? The things that maybe aren't so strange for people initially looking at.
The mainstream. Anything with pasta.
Yeah.
Anything. I always tell people when they're first starting, think Italian.
Okay.
Seriously. I mean, almost every group, ethnic group, likes Italian food, and it's a very simple, you know, ethnic food to make vegan.
You can toss anything in a sauce.
And I think most people are not afraid of pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the acid.
So what did you end up eating on Passover? What do you eat now? What are some of the ideas that you
I make like these mushroom cutlets, using mushrooms and potatoes with a gravy.
Mm-hmm.
I make like a vegetarian stuffing using matzo meal.
Mm-hmm.
Matzo.
For people, I guess for people who are interested in pursuing and looking into your books further, they can, should they access them directly through the Vegetarian Resource Group?
Right. You can go to our website, which is probably easy for Canadians. It's www.vrg.org. And if you want to get our magazine, which is a quarterly from Canada, it's $32 a year. You can do that online, or you can call us in the U.S. at 410-366-8343, and we'd be glad to help you. We have, if anyone goes online, you can print out a huge amount of materials. We have a lot of recipes online. You can join. You can buy books from us.
Cool.
It would be great. So we can keep doing this.
We only have about 5 more minutes left, and a few weeks ago we did a show on activist burnout, and I'm always impressed to talk with somebody who's been involved with looking at these issues for a number of years. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, just before we end the interview, about your journey with vegetarianism and how you prevent, if you do, just burnout, and how do you keep motivated?
Sure. That's a very good question. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners are new activists. And over the years, I've seen many, many wonderful activists burn out quickly. And personally, I think sometimes it might be due to impatience. I have a lot of patience, and I know that to make real change takes a lot of time. I've always been interested in making real change in the world. And I know that's not easy. And the older you get, the more you know how that's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of what we do as an organization is not fancy, but it necessitates a lot of hard work. we're really trying to change entire systems, and it's not very easy. So I say that you have to hang in there for the long haul, or else nothing in the world will ever change. I think that people get frustrated if they go into it expecting that they're going to see quick fixes and quick changes. You won't always see it. I mean, I think sometimes you have to be happy for a while with small changes, knowing that the more people you personally influence, they're going to influence other people and it snowballs. And I guess I know for myself that having done this with, you know, over 25 years now, that, you know, Vegetarian Resource Group and a lot of other groups have contributed to making a lot of change already. And I'm sure there are days like, oh, God, going backwards, like when Atkins diet comes out. But, you know, actually, I think it's the same people, generally speaking, that were there in the first place. They just have an excuse now to eat that way. But there's, I mean, 25 years ago when I started doing this, if you walked into a supermarket, everything was white. There's white flour, white bread, white rice. You know what I mean. And today you can go into a mainstream supermarket and find soy products. You can find organic produce here. You can find, you know, veggie milk, soy milk everywhere. It's slow. You can go out to mainstream restaurants. You have chains adding veggie burgers. Yes, I wish it would happen a lot faster, but you have to have patience.
We only have just a couple more minutes left, but I'm really curious about, you sort of alluded to this at the beginning of the program about just wanting a less violent world. Is that what brought you to vegetarianism in the first place?
Sure. I was a graduate student in Washington, D.C. at Georgetown University studying international relations, and my interests that I had when I went into that program were world hunger and other issues and also promoting nonviolence. And I was in a lot of foreign policy classes at Georgetown University, and constantly I was like the token person whenever we discussed something that I would suggest that people try a nonviolent way to solve a problem in the world, and they would all kind of look at me and roll their eyes, you know, which is kind of sad. But anyhow, I constantly was doing it, and one time I was with a group of graduate students, which at Georgetown everyone sits around and discusses all the world's problems, and someone said to me out of the blue, who was non-vegetarian, do you eat meat? And I said, yes. And they said, well, don't you think it's violent to eat animals? And right away, I knew they were right. And I just said, well, it follows along with my logic that, you know, if I, that for ethical reasons, I, you know, believe in nonviolence. It makes sense that I shouldn't be eating animals. And so I had a strong reason to quickly change. And it's been easy because it just fits into my whole philosophy in the whole world.
And that, I guess that sort of was a moment that initiated you to learn more about all the impacts.
Fortunately, I had met vegetarians and knew people I could ask a million questions, which I did, and now I'm answering other people's questions.
Right. And the Vegetarian Resource Group sounds like it's always happy to answer people's questions about vegetarianism.
That's what we do all the time.
And your hours of operation, if people do want to call?
If they want to call, we're on the East Coast in the U.S., we're open Monday to Friday, through Friday, 9 to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And like I said, a lot of the questions would be answered on our website, vrg.org.
Super. Deborah, it's been an honor speaking with you today.
Oh, thank you. And I just want to say quickly that when I started doing this, I would never have believed there'd be all these shows around the U.S., both TV and radio, promoting animal rights, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Keep
it
up.
It is pretty cool. Thanks again.